Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, folks. I wanted to pass along a terrific job opportunity at the Carter Center for someone with China experience and good writing, analytical, and communication skills. The Carter Center is a not-for-profit, non-governmental organization founded in 1982 in Atlanta by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and his wife, Rosalind, in partnership with Emory University. The center has helped to improve millions of lives in more than 80 countries by waging peace, fighting disease, and building hope. For decades, this has included programming to wage peace between the United States and China. The Office of the Vice President for Peace Programs at the Carter Center is hiring a senior program associate to design, implement, and manage its portfolio of China-focused projects. They will work with the center's senior advisor on China, Dr. Yawei Liu, by editing the U.S.-China Perception Monitor, organizing Track 2 dialogues between American and Chinese experts, and conducting their own line of research and writing. If this sounds like something that you or someone you know would be interested in, then visit the Carter Center's website for more information. That is at uscnpm.org. That's uscnpm.org. Now on with the show. Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China. In this program, we'll look at books, ideas, new research, intellectual currents, and cultural trends that can help us better understand what's happening in China's politics, foreign relations, economics, and society. Join me each week for in-depth conversations that shed more light and bring less heat to how we think and talk about China. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Seneca is supported this year by the Center for East Asian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a national resource center for the study of East Asia. The Seneca podcast will remain free, but if you work for an organization that believes in what I'm doing with the podcast, please consider lending your support, just as Wisconsin-Madison has. You can get me at senecapod@gmail.com. And listeners, please, please, please support my work on Substack at seneca.substack.com. There you will find, in addition to the podcast, the complete transcript of the show, a weekly essay from me, and now a wide range of offerings, including James Carter's This Week in China's History, Paul French's Ultimate China Bookshelf, Andrew Methvin's Chinese Phrase of the Week, the You Can Learn Chinese podcast from Jared Turner and John Pasden, and, of course, the outstanding China Global South podcast and an essay each week from our friends at the China Global South Project. Today on Seneca, I am delighted to welcome Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief of the New York Times, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with many years of experience in China. Jane left China in 2019 and has joined my profession, such as it is, by creating a couple of podcast series on China, The Great Wager, which was about the Nixon-Kissinger opening to China and its fate, and now the series Face Off, produced in her capacity as a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. You may recall Rana Mitter plugging Face Off in his recent appearance on Seneca. Today, we'll talk about this new podcast, which looks at the troubled U.S.-China relationship from multiple angles, from technology to nuclear war, from the Taiwan issue to cultural exchange. We'll also chat about the state of American reporting on China and the challenges of trying to cover a country as enormous and consequential as China with a pitifully small number of reporters on the ground following the expulsions of so many of them. And we'll talk about what insights Jane has gleaned in the past several years as she's focused her reporter's eye on China's President and CPC General Secretary Xi Jinping. Jane Perlez, welcome back to Seneca. It's been a long time. When were you last on?
Well, it's great to be here. And Kaiser, I don't know if you recall, but we were last on in Beijing in 2013, I believe.
Oh, my God.
And it was on the fourth floor of a walk-up. And you were in front of the mic, and there was beer on the concrete floor, and Anand Krishnan from the Hindu was there. And I'm embarrassed to say, I think we even talked about Xi Jinping's wife and how she was going to join Xi Jinping on some overseas trip. I mean, it seems so trivial.
It must have been India, yeah.
I don't quite remember where they were going.
Yeah, Anand Krishnan, boy, I miss him. He is just one of my favorite guests of all time. Yeah, he's one other casualty. He's no longer in China, as you know. He was such a great reporter there.
Definitely. But I was in touch with him the other day, and he's going back from time to time. So at least he's not shut out completely. And I'm sure he's doing great work back at the Hindu in India.
Yeah. So Jane, catch us up on what you've been doing since you left Beijing in 2019. I think the last time I saw you was that year. It was maybe 2020. Anyway, just before the pandemic, when you came down to Chapel Hill and gave a talk that I attended.
Well, I have to say that I sort of think of myself as having migrated to your profession, podcast land. When I left in 2019, I was lucky to get a fellowship at the Shorenstein here at Harvard. And I asked them, so I'm supposed to write a paper, right? And they said, yes. And I said, how many words? And they said, 25,000. I said, forget it. I'm not doing 25,000 words. I've never written that many in my life, and I'm not doing now. I'm going to do a podcast. So I was lucky because Adam Moss, the great editor of New York Magazine and various other things, was also a fellow. And I turned to Adam and I said, you know, I'd like to do a podcast.
What is a podcast?
Yeah, exactly. What should I do? And he said, well, you need to get yourself a producer. Oh, I said, okay. So I found a great producer, Jeb Sharp, who had worked at NPR. And she came over to this place at Shorenstein, and she talked to me, and I told her about my time in China, and she seemed to be interested. And so we did a podcast called On the Trail with Xi Jinping, and we talked to all kinds of people about Xi Jinping. It was fun.
I want to talk to you about that. Jeb Sharp, I remember her. She was at PRI's The World.
Definitely.
She's great.
And she's now teaching at Northeastern University.
Yeah, she worked with Marco Werman, who I have a huge man crush on. Marco is just amazing. Like my favorite radio person. Love his voice, love his amazing grasp of world music. I mean, he just always has great, great music to share. I love that guy. Anyway, he's from Chapel Hill, actually, as it turns out.
Well, Jeb taught me, I've got so much to learn. She taught me about 0.5% of what I need to know, but she was great fun to work with, and we traipsed all around the place and interviewed Kevin Rudd and various other people about what their experiences with Xi Jinping. So, and I related some of my experiences, and somehow we put together 25 minutes. So that was a great experience. And I discovered I loved talking into a microphone and talking to people that way rather than running around with a notebook.
Yeah, it's a lot more fun. I have to say, I follow the same path. I just kind of gave up this whole writing for a living. Now, of course, I've stupidly kind of promised these subscribers that I'm going to, you know, give them a big essay every week. So that's actually taking up more time probably than the podcast. But anyway, when you came down to Chapel Hill, your talk was about Xi Jinping, and I know you've done quite a bit of work, including, you know, that podcast On the Trail of Xi Jinping. There have been quite a number of podcasts now about him, directly or indirectly. They've sought to, you know, kind of provide a little bit of insight into the mystery of who he is, what makes him tick, what he really wants. You, of course, know The Prince, that podcast.
Fantastic. I think it's absolutely amazing. Yeah. They did an amazing, amazing job. There's only one little flaw with it. I think they seemed to promise up front that they would unfold and reveal the big secret of what had really happened to Xi Jinping when he disappeared, if you remember, just before he took office. And they emphasized this in their intro. And I thought, wow, they're going to have this great story. They're going to tell us where he went. But then that's the only thing that they didn't quite deliver on.
Do you have a theory?
I have no theory. I mean, in fact, I asked somebody a couple of weeks ago who had looked into it, and they just said, well, looks as though he went away and had a little study group with some of his peers about what to do. It was in the wake of the Bolshevik thing, and but I have no idea. No idea where he was. I just don't believe the story that he was knocked about by guards and around a swimming pool. That seemed too preposterous.
Huh. I mean, I've heard that so many times now that I thought that there might be something to it, but yeah.
Very hard to tell.
Yeah, very, very hard to tell. But anyway, there's also, of course, you know, Kevin Rudd's work. He was doing a DPhil actually at Oxford, studying with Rana, in fact.
Exactly.
I actually have a Google Scholar alert set up on my computer to tell me every time there's a new academic paper that mentions Xi Jinping in the abstract or in the title. So, I mean, I know there's an awful lot that's done on him. You had Liz Economy's book about him, and that doorstop of a biography by Alfred Chan called Xi Jinping, Political Career, Governance, and Leadership, 1953 to 2018. And then you have Carrie Brown's book. You have, it's called CEO, China.
But I think there's yet to be anything that's really definitive. And I think we're waiting for Joseph Torrigan's book on Xi Jinping's father to find out some of the origin story. And then after that, who knows what's going to come out. But there needs to be something that's quite detailed, I think, like Chen Jian is coming up with a book on Zhou Enlai, which everybody is looking forward to. So I'm waiting for the big book on Xi Jinping, even while he's alive.
Yeah. Did you read Alfred Chan's book? You didn't think that enormous tome quite got it yet? Or
no, I looked at it, but it was too dense for me, to be honest. I couldn't quite fathom that. But I think the bottom line really is, and I think we interview Min Chin Pei for our episode on the Biden-Xi Jinping relationship. And I think Min Chin basically says he's a great politician. He hid who he was, and he came out to be something that even the seven leaders on the standing committee back in 2007, when they chose him, they didn't know who he was, and he hid his colors while he was vice president and spent a lot of time traveling around the world. And when he was traveling around the world, he didn't show his colors to the people he spoke to there. I think Kevin Rudd's got a really interesting anecdote on Xi Jinping, who came to Australia a number of times when he was vice president. And he had a dinner at the Lodge, which is the Australia's equivalent of the White House. And after the dinner was finished, Kevin tells the story of having Xi Jinping fireside chat and bringing up a question about South Korea and North Korea, and Xi Jinping just refused to budge from the official line. Very, very, very controlled, very hidden.
Yeah, yeah. And this was on or off the record. I mean, I imagine he's a different person, or maybe not.
You mean on or off the record Xi Jinping?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, when Kevin talked to him there, was this with media in the
audience? No. Or? This was, as I said, it was after a dinner. It was a fireside chat. It was...
Oh, like just a fire... No, I mean, I'm now used to hearing fireside chat and thinking, you know, two people in front of a figurative fireplace in front of an audience.
There wasn't a journalist to be found. It was, a mano a mano, or however. I mean, maybe there were probably a couple of other people there, but it was...
Yeah, interpreter. Oh, I guess Kevin wouldn't need an interpreter, would he? As he's fond of reminding us.
This is true.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyway, let's talk about Face Off, which has been really fun to listen to so far. You've landed some outstanding guests. I mean, the three that I've listened to so far have all just been great in that way. You had the admirable Admiral Scott Swift, who, I mean, I have to say, he really pleasantly surprised me with how just incredibly reasonable he was, how measured.
That's why I chose
how
him.
Much sense he made. Yeah.
Definitely why I chose him.
You didn't go with Davidson? No, he was fantastic. I thought that was a very, very, very good episode on a difficult topic, right? Naval competition in the South China Sea. And the Apple episode, of course, had the great Wayne Ma, who used to be in Beijing with the Wall Street Journal, covering just a bunch of interesting beats. I think, of course, Wayne is now with The Information. And then you had Zhao Tong at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He used to be over at Carnegie China in Beijing. I have to say, he was amazing. I was actually, I will confess to a little bit of jealousy that you got to him before I could. What a great pick.
Right.
The format of the show is really well thought through. It's short, but you know, you start with sort of your intro, and then you know where you lay down a lot of the historical context. You often have some good tape, you know, from the archives, and then a good in-depth interview, really nice and focused, and then sort of a chat with Rana afterward in reflection. That I think is a fantastic format. And as again, your guests seem to be just so well chosen. I know there's some really, really fun ones in the wings right now, too. So, Jane, talk a little bit about your vision for the show and maybe reflect on some of the things you've learned along the way.
Look, I'll just say a couple of things. I was very keen to do a podcast that appealed to a general audience. I often say to my friends in New York, you know, you all know about Europe and Russia, and, you know, when we sit around the dinner table, you know, lots of detail and animated discussion. But as soon as I bring up China, their eyes glaze over. Honestly, the knowledge about China on the East Coast, I think, is just too depleted, too little. So I don't want to sound too lofty, but I'm hoping that we've created a show that appeals to the experts like you, Kaiser, but also to a general audience. And so to do that, I went back to this original thing that Adam Moss said, you've got to find yourself a producer. So I think I found, if I may say, just so lucky and so fortunate, so much serendipity, I found two great producers, Mia Lobel, who was a big deal at Pushkin Industries. She's the executive producer. And Nina Pozuki, who's here in Cambridge, who worked for The World and NPR for many years. And together, they have really brought, I think, some discipline, but some interest, general interest way of attracting an audience. And as you say, it's the podcast, each episode is quite well organized into three parts. And that's quite purposeful to make it easy for outsiders who don't know a lot about China to really listen to it. So fingers crossed, hoping we get a general audience as well as the experts.
You know, Jane, you remind me of a little anecdote of mine. Not too long after I came back to the States and started doing Seneca here, I hit on the idea of approaching WNYC or, you know, some big NPR affiliate about doing a more popular China show, right? Something that would, you know, be on their podcast network and hopefully on the air with some NPR affiliates. And I had a couple of really great meetings with some very senior people there. When I suggested at one point, I said, so a China 101, yeah? And one gentleman looked at me and said, no, a China 201. And I thought that was kind of brilliant. He said something that's really stuck with me. He said that NPR audiences experience an extreme anxiety when they realize there is something very, very important that they know very little about. And so they don't want to be talked down to. You want to sort of make it a 201. You want to make them feel a little bit like that lower division student in an upper division class, you know, where there's something aspirational, where, you know, they don't want. So I thought that was a really good kind of measure. And if I ever do a show that's kind of pitched at that audience, a wider non-specialist audience, Seneca's obviously not that show, I would try to think of it that way.
Well, we try to appeal to both, actually.
Yeah, no, that's tough.
So, for example, in the nuclear episode, where Zhao Tong talks so eloquently about the looming, the incredible situation between the United States and China, with China expanding its nuclear weapons so rapidly under Xi Jinping, and what is really what he calls quite an alarming situation, particularly since there are no arms control treaties. We open that episode with going down memory lane to On the Beach, which is an old classic movie from 1959 with Gregory Peck and Ava Gardner, and they're both in Melbourne, Australia, waiting for the nuclear cloud to descend, because the Northern Hemisphere has just been wiped out by a nuclear holocaust, and people in Australia are waiting for the worst to come. We have some dialogue from that movie, which is quite moving, I have to say.
Yeah, my folks had that book on their shelves at home, and I used to see it all the time. And I sort of flipped through it, and I understood the premise of it. Growing up in the States in the 80s, there was, it's probably in 83 or 82, there was a TV movie called The Day After, which was premised on something similar. It was a nuclear strike. I mean, it was pretty horrifying, and it really scarred a lot of us. I went on to name my high school proto heavy metal band. And it was really just the worst band that's ever existed. It was called Fallout.
Very, 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 very nice name. So we have another very interesting intro, I think, with our first episode, which is about the South China Sea, where we were very lucky.
That cockpit recording, got, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So we talk about the EP3 incident in 2001, in April 2001, when the Chinese fighter jet collided with an American surveillance plane. And just before that incident, which forced the American plane to land on Hainan, a couple of months before that, there was a very close shave between those two same planes, and we were able to get the recording from the cockpit as the Chinese fighter jet was getting very close to the American surveillance plane. And we have the cockpit recording of Shane Osborne, the pilot, just so alarmed and describing how the Chinese fighter jet was just 20 feet away.
Yeah, and he could see the guy, his facial features just right through the glasses.
Wang Wei, who unfortunately died in the incident with the EP3 and is now, of course, a national hero in China.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to go back and ask you about that episode with Zhao Tong on the nuclear issue, on China's decision to upgrade and expand its nuclear force and make substantial changes to its nuclear doctrine, all of which, Zhao Tong talks about really, really expertly. But he kept coming back to one idea, and it's something that, honestly, I wish you had maybe brought up with Rana, because I would have been really keen to hear his perspectives on this. It was this idea that the U.S. fundamentally misunderstands a lot of China's behavior, that it is actually driven much more by insecurity than by, hubris or by, like a desire for territorial aggrandizement. And I thought that was really the big takeaway from Zhao Tong's, interview. I'm very much of the mind that, a lot of Chinese behavior we can chalk it up to, even stuff that we read as very aggressive is actually motivated by insecurity. I did a show a couple years ago with Sulman Wasif Khan at the Fletcher School at Tufts, who, by the way, is going to be back on the show to talk about his new book on Taiwan. But we talked about his earlier book, which was called Haunted by Chaos. It was about, Chinese grand strategy and how it is actually all about insecurity. And I thought it was a really, really good point. But you and Ron didn't really address this. You talked, about instead things like the expanded nuclear arsenal as a Xi Jinping prestige project, possibly, or part of Xi's intent, to replace the U.S. as number one. Neither of these things Zhao Tong really seems to believe, or certainly, didn't talk directly to. What was your impression of that? I mean, when he said something like that,
I think he means what he said. I think he means what he said, that the Chinese feel surrounded, that they feel that this is his point of view. I'm not a nuclear expert. I'm a journalist, so I interview him, and I'm very interested in what he has to say.
Right. I was more interested in why you didn't raise this with Rana, because it just feels like the nub.
What can I say? We didn't address it, and that's a shortcoming, and next time we will.
Oh, no, I didn't mean that. I mean, I really didn't mean it as criticism. I just wanted to understand your process. But what I thought was really great in that conversation was how you talked about AI and, whether at least the United States and China can come to some sort of agreement about, human agency in pushing the button, right?
I think that's very, very important point. And I think that Zhao Tong made very clear one of the most sobering parts of this situation with the Chinese increasing their arsenal is that they're doing so at a time when they're is just one nuclear control, one arms control treaty left, and it's due to expire next year. This is all happening when there are basically no arms control treaties. And Zhao Tong makes the point that there's not a lot of political impetus in China, it seems, to agree to renewal of arms control treaties or to go down that path. And the United States doesn't seem to be pushing that either. So this is happening. What he calls, I think he doesn't use the word alarming, but close to this very alarming situation is occurring when both sides are going into what's really new territory of no arms control treaties. So when you look back to the 70s, for example, the 70s looked like such a much more simpler controlled situation because there were arms control treaties between the Soviet Union and the United States. And I think that's one of the most worrying things about the situation between the United States and China is this lack of arms control treaties and the lack of drive to get to them and basically the lack of serious talk. Right. Look, we closed the... We have 8 episodes, and our last episode is on Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And we interview Lyle Goldstein, who I think is really so balanced and so knowledgeable because he's not only a China expert who speaks Chinese about, and he knows the Chinese military, he also speaks Russian and knows the Russian situation. And he points out that the situation is getting very scary over Taiwan for this particular reason, that in October last year, the Atlantic Council released a paper by Matthew Koenig and another about how the United States may or should rely on nuclear weapons in a war over Taiwan because the United States is losing its conventional edge in Asia and that nuclear weapons may need to be used. I mean, this is a really very scary situation. So I just thought that the way to close the series after listening to this scary stuff is to go back to Phil Zelikow and Blackwell, who wrote a very interesting piece for the Council on Foreign Relations last year, in which they also have very pessimistic conclusion, in which they say that the confrontation between the United States and China is perhaps insoluble because both are seeking primacy in Asia, that there's no grand bargain to be had, and that the only way that's going to stop this ending in catastrophe is for there to be quality diplomacy.
Right.
The emphasis being, in my book, on quality. And at the moment, we're seeing a little bit of, I sort of think, you know, make-do diplomacy because, you know, with between the Biden administration and Beijing, you know, sort of filling the gap until November. I mean, it's good that they're talking. It's good that Blinken is going. It's good that excellent that Janet Yellen went. It's good that Biden made a call. All that is good, but it sort of feels like make-do. It doesn't really feel like the quality diplomacy that the two, Blackwell and Zelikow, were talking about last year. That's the really worrying thing, I think. So in a way, I hope the podcast Face Off alerts people to the really serious situation. But there are ways that it can be, you know, there are some ways around the edges to solve this by quality diplomacy.
Amen. I think, though, that quality is fine, but quantity has a quality all its own.
That's true.
Yeah,
I'd
like
agree
to see
that.
More of it. I mean, you know, I'd like to go back to the S&DD, where you had these engagements.
Oh, I disagree. I disagree totally. I saw those S&D mammoth wrote. They were just a dog and pony show, honestly.
See, you know,
500 people would come from the State Department to Beijing. They would have spent all year preparing for this thing. And then they'd sit around for 2 days in what was supposed to be really important meetings. And do you know the one that I attended in Beijing? It ended up with Kerry was then Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. He had nothing else to do but to go and inspect a room, large room, with panels of African wildlife on the walls. And this was supposed to be some big deal of the United States and China sharing interest in controlling Africa, in controlling African wildlife. I mean, it was such a waste of time. It was just ridiculous.
So,
I'm sorry.
I get that, but that's only the visible part. You know, that's only the piece of the iceberg above the waterline. What happens with S&DD is there are continuous meetings of these bureaucrats and their counterparts across the whole year, right? And that's, you know, there's the dog and pony show, and I understand how, you know, the optics of that can be absolutely terrible, but there's a lot more to it. I think you probably are fully aware.
Well, there is a lot more. There probably was a lot more to it, but I'm not sure how useful those meetings were. And at the same time, you know, I think they were an excuse for not doing anything. And at the same time, for example, during the Obama administration, there were serious things going on in the South China Sea with the building of the artificial islands by China, and the United States was totally distracted by Iraq and Afghanistan, and there were a lot of lost opportunities, and I don't think the S&ED dialogues with, you know, mammoth meetings at the State Department all year about how to prepare for the Beijing meeting really added to terribly much. So maybe that's where we have a fundamental difference.
Yeah, maybe it is. I mean, because I don't see, you know, that one issue and failure to make progress on that one issue as canceling out all the other stuff. I mean, the relatively minor little agreements on, you know, across all different domains in which, you know, they were engaging. I still kind of believe in engagement as entanglement, you know, just having that level of cross-pollination at all these different levels.
You can have that entanglement, I think, but at the same time, the big issues seem to be ignored. So I'm against entanglement when the big issues are ignored. If entanglement leads to big issues being taken care of, being addressed, and some kind of solutions, fine. But there's often not enough energy to do both, and I think the energy would be better devoted to the big things rather than the entanglement. But that's our difference.
Let's move on to something more pleasant. You are going to be doing an episode with Yo-Yo Ma, who I've had the enormous privilege of meeting.
Did you? Where did you meet him?
Oh, I met him. So I had dinner with him at that. I don't know if you remember, but I think it was 2012 or so, maybe 2014. The Asian Society, Orville Schell, brought over a whole bunch of American, you know, Hollywood people, like one of the Coen brothers and Meryl Streep. And
incident there where I think Meryl Streep and Yo-Yo Ma sort of flattened themselves on the floor in front of each other and in front of a big audience in Beijing.
Yeah,
very, very funny.
So, yeah, so I actually got sat. I was sitting at the table somehow. The protocol officer tapped me on the shoulder and said, "There's an extra seat now at the ambassador's table. We'd like you to be there because we think, you know." So they put me at the table, and I was across from Jonathan Spence next to Yo-Yo Ma.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you must have been in heaven, Kaiser.
It was fun. It was actually a really, really engaging, fun conversation. And then I ran into him a couple more times in Switzerland, and he remembered me and shouted my name down a hall. That was really very nice. So
we spoke to him in this very studio where I'm talking to you from.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
Yo-Yo, I was, to be honest with you, I was so nervous for 3 weeks beforehand, for ages.
I can imagine.
I've interviewed millions of people as a journalist in many, many parts of the world, but for some reason I just thought, oh my God, Yo-Yo Ma, what am I going to do? And so I asked a friend and he said, well, you can't over-prepare. So I really prepared. And he walked into the door of this studio, actually, and he was so charming, yeah. I nearly fell on the floor. And we were just talking, and then I thought to myself, well, I better say we're going to start now. But then I realized that he'd taken over everything and charmed everybody that we'd already started. So
I can't wait to hear that conversation.
It was absolutely fantastic. And I just admire him so much because he really does believe, I think, in the power of culture over politics.
Yeah.
And that is really he doesn't say it, of course, in such a clumsy way. But just by talking about his childhood in Paris and being born on the coldest day in Paris in a long, long time, and then describing coming to the United States as a 7-year-old and playing for JFK, and of course, not having a clue who JFK was, but being totally mesmerized by Danny Kaye and thinking, oh, that's what I want to be. You know, here he is, a 7-year-old, beautifully playing for the president of the United States, but he really loves the guy who's talking to the orchestra. And, you know, there is a little bit of Danny Kaye in Yo-Yo Ma when he talks to the orchestra.
Absolutely. The humor, the warmth, just the humaneness of the man, it seeps out all his pores. He's amazing.
I was so appreciative that he agreed to be interviewed. I think it's in part, if I may say, because he just lives not so far away, and he went to Harvard, and I think he has a very fond connection with Harvard, and his two kids came here, so it was really, I would, you know, the cliche would be a great honor. Of course it was a great honor, but it was a great pleasure too.
Jane, did you ever read the novel My Old Home that Orville Schell wrote just a few years ago?
I have it on my bookshelf, and I have started it, and I am going to make it my summer reading when I go to Europe next month, because I'm just dying to read that version of the Cultural Revolution.
It's really good, but I bring this up because there is a long Yo-Yo Ma cameo in there.
That really?
It was, yeah, and it was obvious to me that Orville drew it from, you know, an experience of his own. And it's just the man so faithfully rendered. It's really nice.
Is Yo-Yo as a child or Yo-Yo?
No. Yo-Yo already as a prestigious, well-known cellist. I mean, a world-class cellist. So he teaches this course. So one of the protagonist of the novel. You know, he's himself a musician. So you'll see, it works really nicely.
But I really understood why Yo-Yo is such a global superstar. It's not only because of his magnificent playing, but because he is the most charming person I've ever met in my entire life, and I've met a lot of people.
The very funny thing, though, is that just last week I interviewed Dave from, CIS.
Also charming, if I may say.
Also,
I saw him
absolutely. But at the end, you know, when we got to recommendations, he talked about, you know, the Bach cello suites, and he wanted to recommend something. And I was sure he was going to recommend Yo-Yo's version of them, but it was Pablo Casals instead. I listened to them side by side, and I have to say, I like the Yo-Yo Ma versions better, but just the recording is different. The recording quality is different. I mean, they're very different. The interpretations are different, but they're worth listening to side by side.
That's so interesting that Dawe chose the Bach suites. I mean, I think one of the pleasures of being in Beijing, actually, was being able to go and listen to classical concerts. And I just love being with the Chinese audience in classical concerts in Beijing.
You know, what they say is that you go to a classical concert now and all the hair is either black or blue, right? Blue-haired old ladies and young Asian people. Saving
classical. Oh, you mean in the United States? Oh, I'm
in
sure.
The United States, yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is the case.
Yeah. That's one thing I really look forward to. I mean, I love seeing stuff at, you know, the Egg, right? It's astonishing. It's a really, really terrific venue.
Very much so.
Let's move on now and talk about another topic that we've both been thinking about an awful lot. And that is, of course, the woefully understaffed U.S. news bureaus and China bureaus that used to have a dozen, in some cases, two dozen accredited journalists, the major newspapers, the wire services. They're now down to tiny little skeleton crews. Let's talk about the causes of this, the dire consequences of it, the fact that despite hearing quite a bit about intentions to address this, to fix the problem, not much has been done yet. So, Jane, maybe we can start with causes. Who fired the first volley? Does that matter?
It certainly matters, and it's really something that I personally feel very concerned about it, and I feel that the situation is totally unnecessary. So the Trump administration decided that they would expel, I think it was about 60 Chinese journalists from the United States, journalists who were representing state-run news organizations, Xinhua and others. And, you know, the alleged reason was, oh, these people are spies, they're writing reports back to Beijing, and we can't tolerate this. And, you know,
wait, was it the Trump administration that said that, or was it the Chinese? They said the same thing, right?
Well, maybe. I don't know. But, I mean, it was unusual for an American administration to say this.
Yeah.
And I have to say that they did this with the full knowledge that there would be retaliation. That's what makes me so wild. And also, so what if a couple of Xinhua reporters are writing reports back to the MSS in Beijing?
Yeah, yeah.
And isn't it better to have these people right in front of you in the United States so you can see what they're doing, if they are doing things that they shouldn't be doing? Much better to have them in front of you than expelling them out.
Amen.
Especially.
Yeah.
So they were sent with their bags packing, and very quickly American news organizations found that their reporters were not having their visas renewed. So American reporters were not so much sent expelled in the way that, I mean, they were expelled, but their visas weren't, by having their visas not renewed.
Yeah,
I think some may have been expelled.
It's
the same thing. The Wall Street Journal, I think, was particularly hard hit because they had a columnist who... Who wrote about the sick man of Asia. So they got hit first. The bottom line is that the Wall Street Journal, I spoke to Ling Ling Wei the other day, they had 23 people in their bureau in Beijing. They now have 3.
That's 23, not including news assistants, not including...
I'm not sure, but they had 23. Okay. Her number was 23.
Wow.
They now have 3. I think that was 3 full-flown, 23 full-flown editors and journalists.
Right.
But I can't be sure about it. They're now down to 3.
My God.
I don't think the Washington Post has anybody posted in China at the moment.
What about the Times?
And the New York Times, we had 8 when I was in Beijing, when I was there as bureau chief, and there are now 2. And I think it's very hard for Western news organizations to hire Chinese researchers, which has been the pattern ever since, you know, Western newspapers opened up bureaus in China. We've always been able to have Chinese researchers who are a very important part of the operation.
The unsung heroes, really.
Yeah, definitely. And some of these young Chinese researchers go on to be very successful journalists, both in China and outside China. So this means that the coverage of China is, at a very critical time, is totally circumscribed. And I think this is how Beijing wants it. And it's how the Trump administration wanted it. I think the Biden administration is trying to correct this. And as I understand it, Secretary of State Blinken raised this question with the Chinese on his last trip, and hopefully he'll do so again on his coming trip. But this is kind of untenable, that the most important relationship that the United States has is under such, so circumscribed in the way that it is reported.
I couldn't agree with you more. But it wasn't just recently, you know, in the most recent Blinken meeting with Wang Yi that this was raised. It was raised in Bali. It was again after, you know, a couple of these Blinken and or Sullivan meetings with their counterparts, you know, with Wang Yi or Yang Jiechi. We saw in the readouts, you know, more often actually just in the sort of off the record or on background reporting, we saw a lot of these vague references to, you know, restoration of journalist visas. In my own conversations with folks from the Chinese embassy, I keep being told that this is on the agenda. They're going to be doing this. They're going to be issuing more visas. They're going to relax policies on Western journalists. They'd be welcomed back, et cetera, et cetera. Any movement on this front that you're aware of?
From what I understand, I just spoke to a couple of people who were affected in New York about this. There seems to be no movement at all. So I think, and I would be fairly pessimistic about it. I mean, I think now that it's done, I think it's very difficult for the Chinese to make what they would see to be concessions on this. And they don't want Western journalists poking around. And not only are there fewer American journalists there, but Western journalists, let's refer to Western journalists, are under a great deal of pressure when they are in China.
Absolutely.
You know, the regime is inculcated this idea that Western journalists are no good, that they're interfering. And I think, for example, the FCC, which is the Foreign Correspondents Club in Beijing, they do an amazing job in sort of trying to look out for the interests of foreign journalists in China. They have regular reports of Western TV people, for example, being beaten up by cops, Chinese cops, when they go to film anything that even resembles a small protest or even not even a protest. They're under great pressure. And I think that the other difficult thing is I think the propaganda machine in China has become quite fierce against the United States, so it becomes more difficult for Western journalists to talk to ordinary Chinese people,
That's
which
right.
is very important. Very difficult for them to talk in a balanced way. And people, Chinese people, are increasingly afraid to talk to foreign journalists. Also, a very serious situation.
This is something, again, that I try to communicate whenever I have an opportunity to talk to somebody who's in a position to influence that in any way in China. I say, you know, think about this. The journalists in China, the ones who are left, still get surveilled. They get harassed. They have sort of this constant drumbeat of suspicion that's being, you know, drummed into the heads of a lot of Chinese people who regard them as people who are out to slander and smear China to ruin its reputation abroad. You know, they're told that there's this cognitive warfare being waged against China, and these are the frontline soldiers in that, right? And so, of course, then you have to contrast this with the way that they're treated in a place like Taiwan, right, where they have incredible access even to quite senior leaders. They get their phone calls returned. Their people are eager to talk. Now, Jeremy Goldcorn and I did a show back when Seneca was still flying the China Project flag, with Mike Chinoy about his terrific book, Assignment China. And Jeremy asked him whether he thought that Taiwan had risen in the American consciousness in part because of the sheer number of American journalists now stationed there. Now, of course, a lot of them have gone on to Korea. But, you know, for a little while, especially right after Hong Kong became kind of an untenable place, a lot of them were in Taiwan. Still, quite a number are in Taiwan. And again, you know, they get treated very, very well there. And so he asked him whether that has had anything to do with the fixation now that we have, the rising sense of danger in Taiwan, with the, you know, obligation that many politicians now feel to take a stand, to visit Taiwan, etc. I mean, I think this is a gigantic own goal on the part of the Chinese. But we asked Mike about this. He was a little vague. He talked more about the difficulties of covering the mainland from Taiwan, which is something I want to talk to you about, you know, difficulties of covering the mainland from outside.
Impossible. I mean, I think it's just a ridiculous idea.
But let me ask you first, what about this issue of Taiwan? What do you think? Do you think that the greater American journalistic presence on Taiwan has changed American, you know, the great American readership's consciousness of that issue?
I mean, I don't want to duck. I'm not trying to be evasive. I mean, I think obviously Taiwan has become a front burner issue, so it's going to be covered. But I do think that Taiwan gets much more coverage now than it has ever before. But that's because the issue is in part, the presence of American journalists there also must help that.
Yeah, sort of that. The drunk looking for his keys under the lamppost, because that's where the light is, right?
Yeah, and I think, for example, the Financial Times has, you know, a couple of reporters in Taiwan who, you know, just report about Taiwan.
Right.
Don't write about the mainland. And those reports get more coverage than they have in the past, which is understandable because of the situation. So it's just not healthy that there are few American journalists in particular on the mainland. It's really a very troubling situation.
How do you see this playing out, though? I mean, do you think that there will eventually be movement? I mean, what does the United States need to do to...
I mean, the United States can't grovel and go to the Chinese and say, beg them to admit back more American journalists, especially when the Chinese don't want to.
They could offer something reciprocal, right? They could say, you know, those 60 who were expelled, let's re-welcome
them. That's not going to happen, I can assure you.
And why not?
I just don't think that the 60...
Not those 60 individuals necessarily, but, you know...
Well, I mean, maybe the... Look, I don't know the intricacies of what's going down now between the Biden administration and Beijing on Chinese journalists in the United States. maybe there could be some gesture where a couple would be, you know, the numbers could be increased in return. But I just get the impression from talking to people who are involved in trying to get more American journalists back into China that it's not moving.
So Jane, just now when I mentioned that he had talked about the difficulty of covering China from outside, and you said, yeah, impossible. I think to an extent that's absolutely true. You know, China's already, the political system is already notoriously opaque. It's already difficult even if you are there, right? So it just makes it all the harder. But, you know, these days we have video chat. We have, you know, WeChat. Okay, maybe that's not safe for people to talk on, but there are other ways to talk to people.
True.
Yeah. And then you also have, you know, I mean, look, 10 or maybe even just 5 years ago, before AI-enabled translation became just so ubiquitous and so affordable, I think it would have been impossible for somebody who doesn't speak or read Chinese to report meaningfully on China from outside of the country. Chinese speakers, you know, we could at least still jump on, you know, like Zoom or whatever and do interviews that way. But
true. It's not as bad as it would have been during the Cold War with the Soviet Union and the United States. No.
Yeah,
that's so true. But there's no substitute for being on the ground, and there's no substitute for going to places on a train or driving, or but particularly going on a train and getting a sense of, you know, what life is like on the ground.
Yeah.
And getting a sense of, so for example, I would be fascinated to, I mean, I think Vivian Wang of the New York Times has just done amazing stuff under very difficult circumstances to get a sense of what young, you know, people in there from, say, 18 to 30 are thinking and doing, and what this lying flat movement is really about. But I think we can't have enough stories about that. So, for example, you know, people say there's nearly 25% unemployment among, you know, people in their 20s. up to 30, whether the number's that big or not, I don't know. But it would be fascinating to know what these people are doing and why that more information on why they're not employed. And the key question is this going to develop into some kind of protest movement? I mean, all those things, it's really important to understand, and we don't really know enough.
So how are you doing it then, you yourself now? I mean, you aren't a Chinese.
Very difficult. Yeah. Very difficult. Yeah. I mean, podcast is a way to do it, but you're not really reporting on China. It's a different way of illuminating questions about China. I just keep repeating myself. You can't duplicate being on the ground.
So you've had, obviously, Chinese people on the podcast, like, you know, Zhao Tong, who only recently came from China. But will the podcast feature interviews with people currently in China?
Well, that's a good question, and this is something I'm pondering for the next series. I mean, I'm very happy that we spoke to Kei Yu Jin about the economy.
London.
Yeah, but she goes back every summer.
Yeah.
And she really understands what's going on. And I think those summer interludes where she goes back are very important.
I'm a fan. I really love her. I think she's just terrific. And I think she gets a very bad rap. I mean, people exaggerate, you know, her privilege or whatever. And, you know, of course, you know, given who her father is and everything. But I think
father, I mean, Jin Luchun, he was one of the people that I really enjoyed going and seeing. He founded the AIIB. I mean, he hardly comes from a princeling background.
Right,
he comes
right.
from a very raw background and got into Beidar or Xinhua, I forget which one, in the late 70s and came to, you know, became a deputy finance minister and was at the ADB when I first met him in 2005 or so. He was based in Manila. I mean, he's not a rich
princeling
guy. He's not a princeling. He's just a very bright guy who, when you go to his office, you see Shakespeare and Patrick White and a whole cast of incredible writing in the English language, which is also very reassuring, I must say. I think he wrote his thesis on Patrick White, the Australian novelist.
Wow. Kuyu told me in our interview that he, you know, her father is a huge Shakespeare fan. and that he sort of lensed everything. He had a Shakespeare reference for basically everything. So, yeah, it's amazing.
Very interesting to find a finance guy with such a library of interesting books, novels, and plays, and Shakespeare, and he in his office, not just at his home, but in his office. That's the interesting part.
Fantastic. Yeah, these are the details you miss when you're not able to, you know, be in people's homes and their offices, right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, Jane, what's next for you? What are you planning on doing now? Is there going to be another season of Face Off? Or
I hope so. And I'm thinking.
Oh, good.
Definitely. And I'm hoping that, you know, we may. I like this this way that Mia LaBelle and Nina Pozzucchi positioned the podcast with a sort of a light introduction and then an interview and then an assessment with Ryan Emitter, who I always think of as the best pal of the podcast. I mean, what more can you ask for than to have Rana's erudition and wisdom about China?
Exactly.
So he and I definitely want to do a second season. Maybe we'll do a slightly different format, make it slightly more immediate, maybe less elaborate production. I have to give a shout out to our sound engineers in Philadelphia, Rohom Productions, who did an amazing job in bringing it all together.
Yeah, yeah.
So we may think of doing something that's slightly more casual. I'm not sure. Maybe we'll take a page from your book, Kaiser.
Well, I look forward to whatever it is that you guys do in terms of the second season. I'm sure it'll be great. And just let me know if there's anything I can do to help out.
Well, thank you.
Certainly would be happy to give it a big plug on this show, because I think it's going to be valuable to all the listeners here.
Well, thank you. And I'm sorry if it's... No, I'm not sorry. I mean, as I said, we do try to appeal to a general audience as well as the very knowledgeables.
Yeah, tough line. But I think you've done it admirably well.
So, thank you.
Jane, thank you so much. Let's move on to recommendations. First, I want to shout out a really big thank you to the University of Wisconsin-Madison and their Center for East Asian Studies, which has been very generous in helping me out this year. And if you work for a university and you've got a center and you think that, you know, supporting Seneca is something that you guys can afford, even if it's just for a small amount, let me know. I'd love to hear from you. And I'd love to give you the kind of attention that your center doubtless deserves. All right, let's move on to recommendations. Jane, what do you have for us?
Well, I am just about a quarter way through Judgment at Tokyo by Gary Bass, and it is the definitive book on the trials of the Japanese regime, which started in 1946. And talking about best pal Rana Mitter, Rana has just written a review of Judgment at Tokyo for the London Review of Books. And he makes a really very, as usual, makes a very distinguished argument for how this is a book that we really needed to understand the Tokyo trials, as they were known, when the Western powers decided to put the Japanese generals and others on trial. And he makes the conclusion that these trials were really important because they were run at a time when there was a belief that law could overcome real politik. And I think it was a very excellent, and he points out it was a very excellent attempt to bring the Japanese to count. And then one of the most interesting parts of the book is the Chinese lawyer, Mei Ruao, who was each major country sent a prosecutor to the trial, and he represented China. He had grown up during the Chiang Kai-shek period, of course. Went to Stanford University, spoke fluent English, so he was an ideal representative for China, which at the time was then starting to go through its own turmoil of the Civil War. And Mei Ruao is a very interesting character because after the trial was over, he went back home and sadly was persecuted during the Cultural Revolution and died very sad circumstances. But a great account and amazing scholarship by Gary Bass, the historian.
Yeah, he was the same age as my grandfather. He was born in 04, so I'm going to look in my grandfather's books if there's any mention of him. Mei Ruao is the jurist who was the Chinese representative at the Tokyo trials. Fantastic recommendation. That goes on my list.
All right.
Thank you. Mine is going to be for Serhii Plokhii's. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but Serhii Plokhii's book, The Russo-Ukrainian War, The Return of History, which was gifted to me a couple of months ago by my friend Vita Golod, who was on the show not long ago for a panel discussion commemorating the second anniversary of Putin's launch of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine on February 24th, 22. This book, which was published last year in 2023, takes us all the way up to the counteroffensive, and it is surprisingly and very admirably dispassionate. It's not that I think that, you know, Putin deserves anything like fair treatment, you know, the fair treatment that Plokhii gives him, but, you know, this is a history book. It's not mere polemic. His condemnation of the invasion is clear, obviously, but, you know, he does a lot more than that. He also writes about the impact of the war globally. I'm only about maybe two-thirds of the way through, but it's really one of the best accounts that I've read. Plokhii is the guy who wrote The Gates of Europe, which a lot of people were talking about back in 2015 after, you know, the war broke out in 2014 and the seizure of Crimea and whatnot. So Plokhii is a professor at Harvard University, and he's an excellent historian. This is very good. It goes all the way back to, well, really, you know, to Kievan Rus and to a lot of the contested history, but also the early Soviet history, the period directly after 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. So, yeah, check it out. It's fantastic. And thank you again to Vita for giving me this book. All right, Jane Perlez, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on Seneca. And congrats on the release of this excellent, excellent podcast, which I hope everyone will find time to listen to.
On Apple, your other favorite places too.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
And please, if you like it, write a review. I'm learning. It makes a big difference.
It does.
We'd love to get the support.
Yeah, as I'm about to tell folks and remind them to do the same for my podcast. But Jane, I hope to see you again soon. And
definitely.
Come on back down to North Carolina. Give another talk. We'd love to hear you.
Will do. Thank you so much, Kaiser. It was a great pleasure to be here, really.
Pleasure was all mine. You've been listening to the Seneca Podcast. The show is produced, recorded, engineered, edited, and mastered by me, Kaiser Guo. Support the show through Substack at seneca.substack.com, where there is a growing offering of terrific original China-related writing and audio. Or email me at senecapod@gmail.com if you have ideas on how you can help out. And don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Enormous gratitude to the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Center for East Asian Studies for supporting the show this year. Thanks once again to Jane Perlez. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week. Take care.